Hello, I'm Arnold Hamilton, editor of the Oklahoma Observer.
And I'm Marianne Martin, and this is ObserverCast, your weekly deep dive into Oklahoma politics and policy.
Presented by the Mary Lou Lemon Foundation.
As we've covered relentlessly here on ObserverCast, the state of Oklahoma talks a big game about being so-called pro-life. But at the end of the day, we're all hat, no cattle when it comes to actually walking the walk to take care of our kids. And once again, the Annie E. Casey Foundation's Kids Count Data Book report this year sets out in stark terms just how poorly Oklahoma ranks in key measures, specifically economic well-being, education, health, family, and community. As we use the rest of the summer to dive into all the ways Superintendent Wrecking Ball Ryan Walters is decimating our public education system and talk with various stakeholders and experts on public education in our state, today we're talking with Shiloh Kantz, the Executive Director of Oklahoma Policy Institute, about what the Kids Count report this year shows us about the state of Oklahoma's kids.
So we usually start it with, tell us who you are and what you do.
All right. I'm Shiloh Kantz. I'm the Executive Director of Oklahoma Policy Institute, which is a nonpartisan or sometimes bipartisan, we say, think and do tank. We used to be a think tank, but putting data and information out on the internet tends to only attract nerds. So we really wanted to see the change and policy moving forward to support folks in Oklahoma that so that they could thrive no matter where they were born, what zip code they were born into, what family situation they live in. We have been doing policy work for 15 years at the intersection of budget and tax policy. So everything we work on from child well-being to immigration intersects with budget and tax policy, including criminal justice reform. So that's our foundation of our work. But we really do believe that in Oklahoma, if we can focus on the kids and our children and the things we can do to fit into the narrative of being the pro-life state that our leaders say they want us to be, we have to care for the kids and show up for our kids post-birth.
So that leads us to the Kids Count report. It comes out every year, and this year's was pretty stark. Can you tell us a little bit about that report, what it means, who's behind it?
Absolutely.
How it reflects the state of Oklahoma?
Yeah. So the Kids Count is a program of the Annie E. Casey Foundation. The Annie E. Casey Foundation was founded, I think, like 100 years ago, came from UPS, the company UPS Money. They have a Kids Count grantee partner in every state and Puerto Rico and DC, I believe. Well, almost every state, I think Montana's got like four, but the Kids Count grantees in each state, it helps to get those data metrics. We're looking at rankings and places where we are measuring exactly how folks are showing up for kids services, state services, families, situational things, schools. How are we serving the children of our state? As the Kids Count grantee in Oklahoma, like I said, we still focus and try to intersect our work into that budget and tax space around children, right? If you don't provide them a living wage for their parents and they can't put food on the table for the kids and then they, you know, can't put a shelter over their home, all of those are trauma to our children and it creates them growing up and doing the same. There's a cycle of trauma that we're trying to interrupt in Oklahoma, right? From not caring for our kids in the right way. So unfortunately, there were actually a couple places we improved here, but we pretty much stayed the same or went worse for most of the overall metrics. We continue to be among the worst states for overall child well-being. We're 46th. That means there's only four others behind us. Only states ranking lower were Nevada, Mississippi, Louisiana, New Mexico. We're 37th in health, which I believe is up a little bit, but that can all be 100% looked as a result of the Medicaid expansion that happened thanks to State Question 802 in 2020 and the PHE, the public health emergency that was in place for COVID that kept people enrolled in Medicaid without having to re-up their eligibility every year. We're 38th in economic well-being, which isn't horrible, but we could do better. 43rd in family and community context and 49th in education. New Mexico is the only one behind us. We firmly believe at OK Policy, education is fundamentally important to every person. I believe the statistic is 1 in 3 Black men Black male children are predicted to end up in prison if they can't read by the third grade. How are we serving our population if we're second to the last in education? How are we disrupting the prison to school pipeline if we're second to last in education, knowing how important literacy is to providing opportunities to thrive for folks? We ranked in the bottom half of the states in 15 of the 16 primary metrics used for the survey. And the only ones we ranked in the top half of the states were the percentage of children living in households that spend more than 30% of their income on housing, where Oklahoma ranked 20th. And this kind of, for us, is an interesting number because we are close to 83,000 units short in Oklahoma for affordable housing, or attainable housing is what we like to call it. That's housing that costs less than 30% of your income that you bring home every month. Our highest categorical ranking this year was on children's health, which I mentioned actually can be looked at and point to Medicaid expansion and the continuation of the public health emergency. But one thing that we do want to emphasize in this year's report was how policy changes can support increasing availability for affordable and accessible childcare. In 21 and 22, 12% of Oklahoma children ages birth to 5 had family member who quit, changed, or refused the job because of problems with childcare. And even if parents can't find an opening at childcare near their home, they can't often pay for it. The typical cost of center-based childcare for a toddler represents 9% of the median income for a married couple in Oklahoma and nearly 30% of a single parent's income. And childcare workers are paid worse than 98% of the other professions in Oklahoma. The median national pay for childcare workers was $13.71 an hour. You can work at McDonald's for $15 an hour. In Oklahoma, the median annual wage for childcare workers was $10.84. So both are lower than the average wage for retail and customer service employees. So to frame this, we say that we could do things like increase the child tax credit, provide it monthly instead of one time at the tax return time. Different ways to really look at how we're making life more, or not even life, but opportunity more attainable for not just our kids, but the families that they're living in. Because if the families are broken or struggling or not supported, the kids are going to see that. We see it in ACEs, the adverse child experiences, right? So those are those ACEs. So we just truly think our kids deserve better. And around the child tax credit, if you guys wanted to point towards it, we do have on our website my testimony in front of the U.S. House Ways and Means Committee when they were at Express Clydesdales in March when they were doing their field hearings. And we really lean into the federal child tax credit there too. But Oklahoma can do a lot and go a long way with looking at the sales tax credit, to increase the sales tax credit that's as old as our policy director. It was created in 1990 and is $40 a person and has never changed. So it's lost 67% of its value. So literally, we had a bill all together this year for increasing that to $200 a person for families. And that's a game changer for some folks, right? That's enough money to pay for childcare, or that's enough money to actually put food on the table or maintain your home if you're on the brink of homelessness. So we truly do think there's easy solutions in our legislature if our legislature and leaders are willing to put those ahead of political moves that look good for reelection.
And how much would that be estimated to have cost the state?
I can get you a number.
The reason I ask, and while you're scouring for the number, we sat on the biggest pot of money in state history this year. And not all of it could be spent for something like that, obviously. And there's always the debate of, recurring expenses, blah, blah, blah. But my guess is that is a
true drop in the bucket.
Oh, yes. It was not large. I'm looking to see. I know I've got it here somewhere. It wasn't outrageous, but I don't want to tell you a wrong number. I think it was less than 200 million, but I don't want to say that and be wrong. Let's see. So
that's a lot of money to me. I could retire on that, but.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I had a funder tell me.
In the scheme of state budgeting with the billions and billions of dollars, you know.
Yeah. I'm going to drop a link in the chat.
You could prioritize that a little better, doesn't it?
Yeah. Arnold, I'm just going to say this out loud. This is a safe space a little bit. I know we're recording, but I don't mind anybody hearing this. If we're truly pro-life, if we truly are going to lean into the fact that we can't have access to health care for women here, and we truly are intent on these babies being born, our state's going to step up and show up for these kids. We just have to. We can't continue to do the same thing we're doing. And that's why, for me, one of the reasons I do this work is because I have three kids. I want them to grow up and I want them to stay in the state. You know, I want them to live here as long as they can. I'm dealing right now with my daughter who was recently diagnosed with juvenile arthritis. Her pediatric rheumatologist is leaving the state August 31st. At our 15th anniversary celebration on June 29th in Oklahoma City, somebody asked me, what keeps you up at night? And I said, work doesn't keep me up at night. What keeps me up at night is my daughter's pediatric rheumatologist dying or leaving the state, because we're already having to drive to Oklahoma City for care every 4 to 6 weeks. The letter was already in the mail. I got home that Saturday and had the letter. We have privilege and resources. I get paid time off. I make enough money that I can pay to go to Oklahoma City for my child, make a 5-hour trip. Now I'm going to have to go to Dallas, Kansas City, Northwest Arkansas, possibly St. Louis, because we've got to actually get accepted somewhere. New patients are scheduling out till February and we're on chemotherapy. And so I can't have my kid from August to February not have care on chemotherapy. So I'm looking at the possibility of, do I leave the state so I can actually have my child receive care, or do I travel? There's so many kids out there that don't get that because their family doesn't have the ability to even get them care. I know somebody that just turned 18 and she's finally getting treated for arthritis because she aged into the adult system of healthcare and can find care in Tulsa.
Well, that's mind-boggling enough that you would have to go to Kansas City or Dallas for something like that. I mean, this is not the rarest of the rarest things.
No, right? No. No, it's not. And it took us 9 months to even get into the doctor. So they're calling 378 patients to let them know. So 380 kids that she's currently treating have no options other than leaving the state. Do you know kids will not have the ability to do that?
What's just as mind-boggling to me, though, is you can't get that in Tulsa. Mm-mm. This is the 21st century.
It is
Tulsa is a big metropolitan, well-heeled, largely, you know.
Yeah, pediatric psychiatrists, also hard to come by in Tulsa.
Yes.
We have two.
In Oklahoma City as well, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's, I keep meeting these people from Tulsa Remote, the thing that GKFF does to bring people, they get $10,000, they stay 2 years. I'm like, where the doctors were focusing on, because literally we are setting our kids up to just in our space and juvenile arthritis and that niche of healthcare, these children who aren't getting treatment now will grow up and their life will be fundamentally changed because their bodies won't work the way they're supposed to because of a childhood illness that could have been treated and possibly sent into remission. And they could have had a completely different life, but because their family was under-resourced or their parent could not take 2 days off to take them to Dallas to go get healthcare treatment, they just will grow up and suffer. And there's this in my moral inside fight, it kills me. Like I could cry about it. It kills me. It just, that breaks my heart. That's when I tell my personal story and say, you guys, I spend hours being my child advocate every day for her health care, and it shouldn't be that hard. It shouldn't be that hard in the system we live in the most resourced country in the world, for it to be this hard for my kid to get health care.
I remember One time I was in the infusion clinic with Zuzu. She needed blood products and in between cycles of chemo. And mm-hmm. It was a day where there just happened to be like 9 kids waiting on blood products. And we got in the infusion clinic. It was around 1 o'clock. But there was a gunshot wound at the adult tower. And so all blood products were being directed to the adult tower. And so all these kids are like waiting with their parents and, you know, to get red blood cells, it takes a couple hours.
Yeah.
But there was a family, a mother and her son. And since we were there for like 7 hours, I like happened to hear like them, because they were having to call Sooner Ride. He was a sickle cell patient, and they were coming from Tulsa, and they were going to have to wait until he was waiting on his blood product till 6-7 o'clock at night, and then was going to hope that Sooner Ride would be come back and get them and get them all the way to Tulsa, right? And I mean.
It's nuts. So this is Shella's 8 got ADD. So I talk like this and I talk like that and I'll circle back. So I'm going to circle back for you, Arnold. The sales tax relief credit would cost the state $120 million.
Wow.
Okay, to put that into perspective,
that's peanuts
to them, right? $120 million. So let's put it into perspective. And this is in that article that you can see that Emma wrote. Eliminating the sales tax on groceries would cut $370 million out of our revenue. This is $120 million, and it's going to the people who need it most. And this is a big caveat here that they don't ever pick up on, is if you eliminate sales tax on groceries, you're not helping SNAP recipients. People who are getting food help do not pay sales tax.
Mm.
The sales tax relief credit, they would still earn. Why, when I can afford to pay sales tax on my groceries, George Kaiser down the street can afford to pay sales tax on his groceries, most of my staff can afford to pay sales tax on their groceries, why would we eliminate a revenue source like that, that's that large, when we could do a tax credit for the people who need it most? That's living your values.
I mean, $120 million. And then you look at other elements, like what it would cost to have a housing first policy for the unhoused, right? Peanuts, and actually much more successful and a lot less expensive than our current policies of incarcerating those who are mentally ill and don't have, you know, stable housing, right? I mean,
yeah, absolutely.
You look at what the state share was going to be for Medicaid expansion. Federal relief dollars came, right?
Yeah,
they're just minute.
But they don't help the 1%, and they don't help them get reelected. And I say that to them all the time. I'm not shy about saying that. Like, until we fundamentally take money out of politics, the money needed to get reelected or run the next race, so they will legislate based on those priorities prior to legislating on the people. So that when we say people over politics, that's what we mean. You're elected to represent your constituents. You should be legislating based on what they need and what they deserve, not what gets you elected for the next race or what your future plans are. And we see too much of that in our legislature right now. It's about who has the power and what can they do with it. And we need people to show up and actually do better for people who are not the most wealthy. We can offer Panasonic close to $1 billion all in.
Think of
$1 billion with a B.
All the social programs that could have just been lined up and knocked out, the waiting list, the DDS, the wait
list. Gone. It'd be gone, eliminated, right? Like literally, if we were actually investing in our people and not corporations and politics. And I think it's very important that people understand, when we say politics, it is very different than policy. When we first started OK Policy 15 years ago, we had a really hard time talking to funders because they said, we don't fund politics. And I said, that's great, because we don't work in politics. We work in policy. And policy is made through facts, data, research, exploring the outcomes of decisions on your populations, especially your marginalized and low income populations, and then making good decisions based on that, right? Like, it's just so very easy to put people first. And I don't understand so our thinking is this at OK Policy. If we can't get the legislature to go, okay, we're going to put people over politics, can we get them to at least buy in for the kids? Can we at least get them to support them? What is the narrative we need to use? So that's how we're thinking about it. What is the narrative? What are the words? What are the languages we need to change so we can compromise and meet lawmakers in a place that's comfortable for them to say, I'm doing the right thing, but benefits the people who cannot afford lobbyists at the Capitol?
But you know, and we've talked about this a number of times, I think, over the years on this podcast, but, you know, Okies, and I'm one, are, you know, if you have a tragedy in your neighborhood, if you, you know, people are there to help.
The Oklahoma standard, yeah.
Yeah, so, but the real Oklahoma standard is, why is that other person getting a government handout? Why is the other person, you know?
It's a zero, they think of it as a zero-sum game, but you know why, Arnold? I have a theory. Here's my theory. We are not in community with folks like we used to be. We are not in relationship with folks like we used to be. We just have, that was one of the conversations we had with the Terrence Crutcher Foundation that Dr. Crutcher brought up when she was presenting, is that where do we feel safe? When's the last time you felt safe? When's the last time you felt supported? It wasn't with police around. It was at home or in your community or in your neighborhood where you could knock on a door and not get shot. That you could knock on a door for a glass of water because you're out playing as a kid and wanted a glass of water and nobody was going to pull a gun on you, right? We've got to stop being us against them. We've got to stop letting leaders, especially political leaders, push us into that zero-sum game and divisiveness. I tell my staff, if you're not in conversation at least once a week with someone that doesn't look like you, believe like you, talk like you, or share your values to understand why you're so different and what difference you have, but more importantly, what similarities you have, then you're not doing your job correctly. And let's have a conversation because I can help you find those people. And so that's what we're even doing at the legislature. David Blatter, founding ED, he gives me a hard time all the time. He's like, you're not putting 5 blogs out every day, or a blog a day, 5 a week. And I was like, yeah, it's intentional. I've asked my policy analysts to take 30% of their time and devote it to being in relationship with somebody somewhere, whether it's a state agency, a lawmaker, an executive assistant at the Capitol, a legislative assistant, a community partner, somebody that is a community partner from somebody that might not agree with what we are pushing for, so that we can learn about each other, learn each other's values, learn where we're more alike than different, and get things done so that Oklahomans can thrive, we can be safe in our communities, and we can have healthy families. It's not a lot to ask.
Well, all this naturally segues, I think, into what we've been talking about for a few weeks here and are going to talk about a few weeks more heading into the school year, and that is public education under siege in Oklahoma, a variety of reasons. Most people, though, I think, for whatever reason, are focused these days on, what are the test results from post-pandemic? You know, and you have this, I'll call it oligarch-fueled right-wing, you know, group that's been fighting to dismantle public education and turn the schools into religious schools and or for-profit schools for years. And they've sort of seized the moment, you know, getting, you know, a governor that they support reelected, getting a state superintendent elected that they support.
But do they?
Well, okay.
Not now. They supported. We'll say they supported, but yes. I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm terrible. I know. I couldn't keep my mouth shut.
No, I know. No. We can explore that more. But, you know, I'm sitting here thinking we had 10 plus years of the nation's worst budget cuts for public education. the pandemic nobody saw coming, and you know, and boy, that hit us hard. Now you have all these policies where you're trying to rob hundreds of millions of dollars more from already underfunded schools and put them in the pockets of people who are sending their kids to private schools. And the thing that to me all too often gets overlooked is the public schools, which welcome all comers, are dealing with this broader society problem that we've been talking about. The kids who show up at school every day are dealing with those those ACEs, the adverse childhood experiences. They're dealing with poverty. They're dealing with having to pack up in the middle of the night and leave because they suddenly, you know, they finally reached a point where the landlord's kicking them out because they can't, they're not getting meals that they deserve. And you have crazy, you know, school superintendents who are sending notices saying your child's not going to be allowed to re-enroll in Marlow because, you know, you still have a bill from your lunch.
Yeah. And what we want to tell them is there's a grant for that through USDA. It's called Community Eligibility Provision, and they could get free school lunch, but that's a whole nother story. But
well, yeah. And Melissa Provenzano will argue with you that it's unconstitutional to deny a child.
Oh yeah, well, you know, but, and for clarity, I'm on the Oklahoma PTA board because I started I was from hospitality industry. I was a controller of a small restaurant group when David hired me to do the finances. That's what I was hired to do part-time. I had no policy training, no nonprofit schooling, nothing. I ran restaurants and did their accounting and was their administrator.
But that's like being in the nonprofit in a lot of cases, isn't it?
Kind of, right? I mean, kind of, because, well, my staff there were the people that our policies were supporting, right, a lot of the time. So I say that to say PTA was my first opening to advocacy, right? So before I knew of OK Policy, I knew of our PTA. My kids are spread out in a way, not on purpose, but my oldest is 24, 19, and then I've got a 13-year-old. So I've seen, I was at one elementary school for 17 years without a break, because that's where all three of my kids went. And to tell them like what a gift that is first, because I went to 8 elementary schools before 4th grade, right? So like, I was like, I was able to disrupt that trauma for my kids, right, that I had. But two, the change in the curriculum from the first kid to the third kid is enormous. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'm gonna start there. So I think there's the teach the test, the metrics, the measurement. We've focused on that for so long that we forget exactly what we need to teach kids in school. I know Amy Curran is at Generation Citizen is leading a thing called Oklahoma Civics Learning Coalition, where they're fiscal sponsor for it, but it's really about pushing civics education to really remind folks at a younger age why it's so important to not be apathetic to the system, right? But I do think that we have fundamentally stopped letting teachers do their jobs, that we have put so much on them. And we have underfunded for so long so many supports that could help these families, to help these kids not come into school and need so much from their teachers and their school system because they can't get it anywhere else. And that's the only place that they're heard, because maybe their kid's acting out, or maybe there's some other issues happening that is presenting them to be able to get some services there. But we've put so much on our schools because we as a society and our leaders as a society have chosen to not fund the services that support our families to stop the generational trauma that many of us experienced as children, that we just are now even being able to name, right? Because there were, growing up, I didn't know, you know, going to 8 elementary schools by 4th grade was unusual. I didn't know that not everybody's grandparents were divorced and everybody's parents weren't married multiple times, right? Like, so there's those pieces and places where if we really, truly, again, are pro-life state, we have to fund our services that support life beyond birth.
Well, and I'll just add too, they don't necessarily support birth because of their policies, right? Like,
no, they just
actual,
do it because
the actual birthing experience is actually a very fraught.
Yes, that's a whole nother story. So here's my favorite statistic to throw around for anybody when I sit down. I heard it about 2 months ago. we have zero practicing doctors in the legislature. We have zero practicing nurses. We have one practicing ophthalmologist. We have 28 pastors. It is an ideological, political environment that was never meant to go hand in hand with church and state. Right?
And you know, listening to you talk about this intentional rhetoric that divides us versus them continually. Who is our boogeyman today?
Who can I blame for my situation? So instead of actually showing up and making decisions and creating policy that supports our families, our lawmakers from the national platforms all the way down to state and local platforms look at who can I blame other than me? Who can I point the finger at? It's not my fault. All while doing and legislating the way that is going to better reinforce their political career most of the time. Not all legislators are that way. I've got former Senator Munson on my team. That woman showed up and she served from her heart because she came from community where her community needed her voice at the Capitol and she showed up authentically with it, right? There are those good legislators out there. We've had good governors, we've had good leaders, but fundamentally, as a whole, our legislature has let our kids down over and over and over again. You can't say we can't do criminal justice reform because it's not safe, and then wonder why in a state that's over-incarcerated almost more than any other place in the world per capita, children are struggling when their parents are ripped out of their home and they're visiting them in prison, right? We're creating ACEs instead of creating solutions.
And I just think of, you know, I wonder how much people really understand what it means that, you know, like on the kids count profile, that 21% of kids live in poverty in the state. You know, that's 1 in 5 kids.
I would put a number to that. I would look and see what the childhood population is and name that number, 21%.
9,000 children, you know, live in poverty.
Yeah, that's
1 in 5. You go to any classroom in the state and if there's 25 kids in there, 5 of them are living in poverty.
Absolutely. And 5 of them probably are having some kind of issue in the classroom or with learning or with schoolwork, not because they're dumb and not because they can't pay attention, but because they're hungry, they're tired, they're embarrassed because they don't have money to buy uniforms or nice shoes and they look like crap and they feel like crap, or their clothes are dirty because they can't do laundry because they don't have washer and dryer because they don't have a home because they're sleeping in their car. We're even doing work with Tulsa Public Schools here where we are going in and we're scraping data off of OSCN.net. We're inputting addresses for eviction filings and we're getting that Tulsa County report to Impact Tulsa, who is working with the intervention specialist at TPS to disrupt homelessness for our kids, that those addresses tie to kids enrolled in TPS. What if we could do that across the state? Right. What if we could get in there and help them and identify them? We've got to stop. And the other thing I would challenge is I would challenge Oklahomans who are wealthy, Oklahomans who do have power because they have money or they have access because they have money. How are you leveraging that for our kids who don't? What are you doing to be a part of the solution versus creating more problems? Because there's a lot of people who think they know what's best for everybody else, but they're not talking to the people who are living in the problems or living closest to the problem. And they know the solution. They know what they need to get themselves out and they know that they can't find it and they've been cut off and they've been cut off because we haven't funded those services.
Am I right to think that there are a whole lot more people with means who simply aren't leveraging those means in a positive mm-hmm. way, but who actually agree that that's an issue?
Uh-huh. Absolutely.
Then there are the ones who sort of are dominating the public policy debate at the state house.
Yeah. There's some level of my money makes me smart and I know better than everybody else. And then they live in the separation and they're unwilling to get back and meet the people that truly can, I mean, they can verbalize, they can tell us what they need. And honest to God, most people just need more money. they need more money, and our wealth gap just keeps growing. That's my soapbox. My personal Shiloh soapbox is the wealth gap. It's true.
There's like plenty of economic research to back that up. A universal basic income has been 100% undoubtedly, like,
look at child tax credit, how well it did during COVID, right? When they upped that and they were sending out monthly, we had less poverty because people had disposable income that they could use that they didn't have before. But it truly is. There was something I read about talking about the Rockefeller, and we all know the wealth and the extravagance in that era, like Jekyll Island and all those places in Georgia, right? And our wealth gap is greater today than it was then. And it's not going to change. I mean, it's just not, because people don't want to, but that's the problem. So the money in politics, and then having money, it gets you access. And so the only people getting to have a say or getting to get invited to the table and get to be in the rooms and talk about the budget, Harold Hamm's my favorite example in this situation. He's on that call or in that circle talking about the state budget. He's not an elected official.
No.
But he's got money.
I just want to double back. There is a whole book by two Nobel Prize winners, Good Economics for Hard Times. Esther Duflo and Abhijit Banerjee, like, they literally go case by case. They totally lay out all the literature that's a case for a universal basic income.
Yeah, no, it's, I mean, we've definitely dipped our toe into it a little bit, but it's something Oklahoma is going to be slow to uptake.
Well, you know, and Harold Hamm is a boogeyman, you know, for those of us who are trying to pursue progressive public policy in this state.
Transparency is what I call it. He's a boogeyman for transparency.
But, you know, what's sad, particularly sad to me, is this is a guy who grew up dirt poor. I mean, literally, dirt floors in the house, you know, the whole bit, and has, you know, with the help of the American system, was able to use it in a way that he could make himself fabulously wealthy. And it's always dispiriting to me to see how, this is my assessment, I don't know the man personally, but that he has forgotten where he came from. You know?
Well, he achieved the American dream because he pulled himself up by his bootstraps, right?
Well, and that's what I wonder is, those guys who have the ear, the ones who are on the speed dial, you know, when you're talking about budget and how it's tax policy and that sort of thing, to them, those folks who need that help that we're talking about in this conversation are people who just aren't working hard enough. They're just not pulling themselves up. Toughen up, buttercup, you know, get it, you know, you just need to, you need to work your way out of it like I did, right?
Right. Because if I did it, anybody can do it. Yeah, but you're a white person in the United States, right? I mean, a white male in the United States, right, in Oklahoma, who is revered. I mean, that's at the end of the day, and that's where I like to lean into. In part of my testimony, I talked about bootstraps, and you'll hear me a lot of times, I'll use especially very conservative, very far right language to describe things, or their words to describe things in our benefit. For example, I talk about corporate welfare. I talk about entitlements for businesses, right? I use the same handouts for businesses, those same languages, because if we frame it and talk about it the same way they're talking about it for people, for businesses, I think it kind of makes it a little bit more apples to apples. But it truly is, my question, or part of my statement when I did my testimony in March was, you know, we have that old saying, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, but were you born with boots? Because I wasn't. We had to borrow them, or we had to get hand-me-downs, or we had to go and get them from the clothing shelter, right? Like, we were living in poverty and we didn't have bootstraps. We didn't have boots. So what was my community doing around me to provide me boots? We're not embracing and growing and pushing people to be in community with one another. We're all about having guns and I call it Bibles, bullets, and babies, right? That's what our focus is on, to the point that when a kid rings somebody's doorbell just because of the color of his skin, he gets shot. He did nothing but go pick up his, try to go pick up his little brother. That fundamentally comes from the top down. They model what they want us to do, and we follow blindly. And I'm ready, and I know many people in the sphere that I work in, we're going to start disrupting that. We're going to start calling it out. We're going to start pushing back, because if we just continue to let it happen, we are just as guilty.
Is it too cynical, or maybe even too conspiratorial, to suggest that there's actually a strategy involved in this?
Oh, I don't think it's conspiratorial at all.
An underbelly of workers, uneducated,
poor, dumb, and controllable.
Mm-hmm. And
right. So I'm not too cynical, and I'm not.
I don't think it's cynical, and I don't think it's conspiratorial. I don't think at all. I think it is, and I don't. So here's what I would say, Arnold. I don't think they consciously said this is what we're going to do, and to do those things. What I do fundamentally believe is that at a moment in time, probably in the 80s, 90s, they recognized, oh, if we continue this way, we get all the shares of all the, right? Like, we get the fruit of all of this other stuff, and we get to enjoy it, and we're going to hoard it and protect it at all costs. And if that means that society around them, that they're part of breaking down society and communities around them, so be it. It's worth it because they get to keep theirs. No, I don't think it's, I think it is cynical, but it's also truthful, right? Like, that's, I joke. So here's how I explain it for my staff. We have to provide hope half the time and keep people from burning everything down half the time. But sometimes we just got to flip a table. Jesus did. If you want to talk about what they say, and that's what I add into it, because again, 28 pastors in the legislature, right? So you got to provide hope half the time, keep everybody from burning things down half the time, but damn it, there's a time to flip tables. And so, this is that time.
And this, you know, I'm just thinking about what you're saying, and like the biggest thing here is like, and I mean, we just cannot discount the role of white evangelical, white Christofascism. I'm sorry.
Nationalism. I mean, the whole white nationalist movement is.
We cannot discount the role of that in here. And if you are convincing people.
Ryan Walters, that's all I got to say. Ryan Walters exists and is where he is because of that.
Empire, you know, like.
He's not a mistake. That's what I keep telling people. They're like, I can't believe that they're not controlling him. I was like, no, they knew exactly what they were biting off. Here's what's going to happen. So here's my theory on Ryan Walters. When the charges come down from Class Wallet, you know how people stand in a line, like when you're like picking teams for like school and you stand in that line and they're, you know, in movies, like they'll be like, I need a volunteer. And everybody, one person takes a step back. So it like makes them look like that they stepped up. When those charges come down, that's what everybody in the administration is going to do. And he's going to be the scapegoat. I was telling my staff that 3 months ago and they're like, no. And I was like, I promise you.
Well, and remember, Kevin Stitt will choose his replacement, which likely will be somebody who's already looped back in and working over there, Janet Barisi.
Exactly.
So, you know.
So we get our dentist back, literally. Yeah. No, that's I'm not gonna say the right has done, because here's my dirty little secret. I'm a registered Republican and have been my whole life. That's how I was raised. I registered at 18 and I never changed it. But in Oklahoma, I get to vote in more elections, and I recognize that that's a privilege because of our closed primaries, right? So I don't want to say the far right, because there are some things that I fundamentally do think that I share values with some of the right. You know, I think we should be fiscally responsible. I think we should really budget. I think that the state should have projections past this year. Why do we have a budget so big that we're not doing forecasting 5-10 years out and modeling and understanding what changes we need to do to make sure that we're not $1 billion short next year? Because we've been there, right? Like, we've been in those places. And if we were proactive in truly leading our nation the way, or even our state, or not our nation, but proactive in leading our state the way we would want it to be led for our family, the way we would want our kids to be treated, the way we would want company at our house to be treated, if we were truly like making policy in a empathetic, people-centric way, we would not be scoring like this on these rankings. our children would not, one in three Black little boys would not be guaranteed, you know, predicted to go to prison if he can't read by third grade. We would be identifying those kids. We would not need nonprofits like us. My goal is to put me out of business. I don't want to exist. I don't want to have to be here and be what Don Milliken, or one of our founding board members, calls the conscience of Oklahoma. Because we're going to call you out if you're doing something that goes against our values and isn't morally the right thing to do for the people of Oklahoma. We don't get to pick what uterus we come out of. We just do, right? And so how is it these kids have to pay for our inability to fund our values?
But isn't the American value system based on the notion that everyone, regardless of race, creed, religion, sexual orientation, whatever it might be, socioeconomic status, should have as equal a chance of climbing that ladder?
Yeah.
As, you know,
anybody else
who are born in South Tulsa,
yeah,
or in Nichols Hills,
right? Yeah, no, I mean, I think Tiffany Crutcher actually said something about when on her panel in there, what was it? She said, she read the second paragraph of the preamble, the Declaration of Independence, the second paragraph of the Declaration of Independence. It talks about safety, and it talks about systems, both the foreign and domestic, that segment. And in there, it says that if these systems are abusive or causing harm to society, we should abolish them and rebuild them in a way that protects our safety and our inalienable rights. So when people, because it came up about a question about abolishing the police and defunding the police, which outside of these safe space conversations, the Crutcher Foundation would never use those words, because they know that it will divide, like it. There's a certain crowd that won't even listen past then, right? But here in the safe space, she said it. And so our board chair was like, you know, why would you say that? And she said, because fundamentally, we've got to rebuild the system. And if we can't rebuild the system, where do we impact the system to better serve our folks? And it's by setting our officers up not to fail, right? It's funding mental health. It's having responders who can go and de-escalate situations, who are trained in de-escalation. It's having more police officers who look like community and know their communities. It's not over-policing a certain area of town just because you can,
you know,
right?
That is ultimately what Audre Lorde said, was the master's tools cannot rebuild the master's house.
Yeah.
You got to
start. Well, and so I heard a really great quote the other day. Our tribal policy analyst, tribal state policy analyst, Vivian Morris, I got to sit through her run through for her. I didn't get to actually see her presentation because I was doing some of these things, but I got to see her run through practice on it. And she gave a quote that stuck with me that I'd never heard. And she said, until the lion can learn to write, the hunter always gets to tell the story.
Wow.
And that one's one they'll punch you in the gut, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So our lions, we're learning to write. And we're going to write until our paws fall off. And march and knock doors and organize and really, truly make people understand that we are here because we let our lawmakers get us here. Apathy is not serving anybody. Not voting is not serving anybody. We need more people running for office. We need more people involved. And if you get involved in the Trump, Biden, this person debate, by God, you better know who your legislator is at 23rd and Lincoln, and you better have a relationship with them. And if you don't, hit me up, because I'll make sure you can meet them, because that's fundamentally where change happens.
And that's where the tables get turned over.
That's exactly right. And not only that, but imagine this. You meet your lawmaker in district outside of session. You have coffee. You get to know them. You invite them out. You meet with them once a quarter, and then session starts and you have an issue and you call them up and they know you. And they have connection to you. And guess how much more impactful that phone call or that email is, because you took the time to be in community with this person, to build a relationship. You showed up for them, they're going to show up for you. that's the skills I'm trying to teach our policy team now. You can write beautifully all day long. You can talk about numbers. I've done it. I've watched it for 13 years with David Blatt. When I presented to the Edmond Democratic Women's Group in May, I walked in and I was like, obviously I'm not David Blatt. I think I'm a little cuter, but obviously not David Blatt, right? I am the executive director of OK Policy, but not David Blatt.
That's pretty low bar set, though. If you're talking about
right. You're cute. I say it to his face anyway. I'm like, I'm the prettier ED. but I'm not David Blatt, and I'm not going to talk to you about numbers. I'm going to talk to you about relationships. And so I spent my first 20 minutes talking to them about how we're changing our work, why we're changing our work, who we're seeking out to change our work. We had a dozen bills go into the legislature this year proactively. 8 of them were authored by Republicans, both houses or both chambers. Republican authors, because we fundamentally know we have to be in relationship with them, and we have to find where we can compromise, and we have to stop looking at what divides us and focus on what brings us together. If we're willing to do that and we're willing to show up for them, they'll eventually get there. It's not a sprint, right? It's a marathon, but we're modeling the behavior we want them to be doing, just like we do with our kids.
So you're a think and do tank.
We're a think and do tank. That's exactly right. We're a think and do tank. We're a think and relationship tank, really. I mean, that's really actively where I think we're leading. And I truly think the power of connection and community fueled with data and facts that are indisputable will eventually win. We'll eventually get there. But it's going to take a lot more than just OK Policy. It's going to take all of us working together in collaboration and in communication. We've got to over-communicate with folks and in a way that is in unity together with the same words, the same messaging, the same modeling, and the same goal of finding an answer for everyone, not just our side and not just our issue.
I think we need to let you go, Shiloh. I know you've got
thank you.
Day,
but yeah, thank well, you. This no, was, thank you. This was good therapy for me. I like it.
Yeah.
Let's do this again. Sure. So.
Yeah, anytime. Like, seriously. And we're happy to, I mean, my staff, too. I will say this. Where I'm also not David Blatt is he very much was the face. I mean, I think it was till 2015 when somebody would say, where do you work? And I'd say, OK Policy. And they're like, I don't know what that is. Oh, I work for David Blatt. Oh, that policy shop. I'm like, I just said that. I just told you the name of it, right? Like, so I very much lean into making sure that they have opportunity to do these things too. So anytime that any of our staff can help out or do any kind of that, they're more than willing, and we're more than willing to let them, because we need them. We need people to know that, and we did a very proactive thing when we found out David was retiring to get people to understand that there were 17 other staff members behind him at the time, but having one person be the face of an organization and only talking and only hearing from them is detrimental to the future of the organization. So I'm very much trying to make sure that our staff gets these opportunities too. So if ever there's something that comes up that you want to speak with them about or anything like that, feel free to reach out. And they always come and ask, hey, somebody asked out, but feel free, because we are here to serve Oklahoma in any way we can to get the information out.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, thank you guys. You guys have been, Arnold, I think the Oklahoma Observer was some of the first checks I ever wrote for David Blatt back in the day. We've been longtime partners, almost as long as I've been here, I think.
Yes.
So thank you for that. Yes. And Marianne, it's lovely, lovely to see you. I hope it's not so long next time.
No.
And holler yeah. If I can do anything, okay?
Yeah,
seriously, I know.
And when you come down to Oklahoma City with your kiddo, let me know and we can help here too.
Okay. Too. Well, thank you guys so much. And I just, like I said, I appreciate people like you who get it. It's
hey,
really
be sure
nice.
Be sure and push your folks at the Summer Institute to sign up for the 1 year free digital so that they can, you know, they're the kind of group that we'd love to connect with us, and part of building this broader community to move the state forward.
Yeah, so. this is our farm league, the Summer Policy Institute. We're up to 435. Yes, yes, I'm telling you.
We can't talk about that so much. Like, we need to build the pipeline. Yes.
We are. Yes. We're up to 435 alumni. We have 5, I believe, alumni in the legislature right now.
435 is a Congress.
Yeah, right? It is a Congress.
Yeah,
I didn't even think about that. I'll be sure to tell them. Yeah, you guys make it where we are the size of the Congress, literally 400, over 10 years, 435 kids. I call them kids. One of our oldest was 55.
Okay.
He was still in college, though, right? Like, yeah. So anyway, well, I appreciate you guys. Have a good day, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you for listening to this episode of ObserverCast. If you like what you hear, please tell your friends about us and share our episodes far and wide on social media. If you're interested in sponsoring ObserverCast, please give Arnold Hamilton a call at 405-478-8700 or drop him an email at ahamilton@okobserver.org. You can also support ObserverCast with a tax-deductible donation to the Oklahoma Observer Democracy Foundation, whose mission is to help create a better, more informed Oklahoma. And to help keep us on the air, visit okobserver.org and click on the Donate button on the upper right side of the homepage. We also urge you to subscribe to the Oklahoma Observer, now in its 55th year of comforting the afflicted and afflicting the comfortable. We have a special digital subscription rate for ObserverCast listeners, only $1.99 a month for the first year. That's 50% off the usual rate for monthly digital subscribers. Just use the coupon code ObserverCast when checking out to get the discount rate. And finally, we want to thank Jared Deck for the music you're listening to in the background here. He's not just a resident of Norman anymore. He is now the Oklahoma State Representative for House District 44. Congratulations, Representative Deck. We're so proud of you. But you can still download his albums at iTunes and learn more, including dates for any upcoming performances at jareddeckmusic.com.